You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair, Part A. The Universe. Chloe, creative director Gabriella Hurst, is drawing fashion inspiration from clean energy, and the results are electrifying, by Keziah Weir, with photographs by Joaquin Eskelson. Opening photo has a view inside ITER. I think by now you know the difference between magnetic fusion and inertial fusion, Gabriella Hurst says to me as she toggles through images of industrial blueprints on her phone. It's a question one might expect to hear in a course on plasma physics, or at least the physics pop quiz of this word person's nightmares. But no, we're in Hurst's sunny New York design studio, settling in to discuss the spring-summer collection from Chloe, where she has held the role of creative director since 2020. Outside the glass door of her office, her team darts between mood boards and clothing racks and models draped in slinky black garments. Inside, wearing a navy silk shirt and a tweed baseball cap, under which she has tucked her blonde hair, Hurst is still and focused. She is making fusion fashion, a concept that has occupied her design mind for the last year. Fusion is the main source of energy in the universe, Hurst says, referring to the process of stellar nucleosynthesis by which protons fuse at the core of all stars, emitting heat and light. We wouldn't be here if it wasn't for fusion, because we are made out of dead stars. One could say the same of her spring-summer collection, which was inspired by site visits to labs in the Pacific Northwest, New England, and the south of France, where hundreds of scientists and engineers are working to develop technology that will produce a net energy gain through fusion, an as yet unattained goal. Hurst and others refer to them as star builders. Nuclear fusion, unlike fission, doesn't produce long-term waste, lacks the potential for meltdown, and has the capacity to produce a lifetime's worth of energy from the hydrogen atoms in a single glass of water. Something of a climate crisis silver bullet. The Chloe models were clad in appropriately physics-inflected designs. Hurst sent a board of 8 fuchsia fabric swatches to one company so that their team could color match the pinky purple shade of a fusion reaction. Hydrogen isotopes, deuterium and tritium, appear as abstract patterns across the clothes. They walked a runway designed to resemble a tokamak, the donut-shaped device that produces energy through the magnetic fusion of atoms. The Mexico-based light artist Paulo Montiel Coppa created enormous incandescent rings representing magnets which floated above the stage. Other designers have attempted to render poetic the ravages of climate change. This spring, Dimna Vizalia sent his models into a human-made blizzard. Following the designation of the monarch butterfly as an endangered species this summer, Colina Strada's September show took place in a preserve amid fields of milkweed. And fashion has publicly struggled with the problems the industry itself creates. A 2020 report by the nonprofit environmental agency Stand.Earth found that the global fashion industry is responsible for more greenhouse gas emissions than both aviation and the shipping sector. Despite customer-facing public commitments by brands and CEOs, LVMH, Kering, Hermes, the largest pieces of the fashion supply chain remain dependent on coal for both electricity generation and heat used in apparel manufacturing, bleaching, dyeing, weaving, finishing garments, transportation. And so the biggest question of all, Hurst believes, is one that faces not just fashion, but all industries in a global system that derives 80% of its power from fossil fuels. Where are we getting our energy? It is the twofold way in which Hearst attempts to grapple with this question that sets her apart, in aesthetics and through action. Her collections broadcast the themes, while Hearst simultaneously enforces transparency and innovation on production levels. Her mission is woven into the very fibers of her clothes. In her early 20s, Hearst developed a trick to alleviate her anxiety. I created this thing called my wish list. Whenever I feel anxiety, I write the opposite of what I feel. The opposite of Hearst's largest anxiety, climate disaster, she realized last year, is climate success. I started repeating it to myself like a mantra, she says. Climate success, climate success, climate success, climate success. Hearst, who was born in Uruguay in 1976 and raised on her father's 17,000-acre Paysandú cattle ranch, Santa Isabel, grew up with an entrenched understanding of conservation and ethical consumption. After her father's death in 2011, Hearst, the eldest of four, inherited her childhood home and its surrounding ranch land. It wasn't until her husband, John Augustine Chilton Hearst, called Austin, pointed out her unique background that she realized what she took for granted about her upbringing might play into her fashion career. He was the first person to say to me, "You need to talk about how you grew up," Hearst says. "You need to use the wool of your farm in your clothing." For this year's Gabriella Hearst Spring Runway show, she produced a broadsheet with images of a recent family visit. Hearst and one of her daughters riding in the back of a truck, a herd of cattle in the sunlight. In her office, the designer taps her finger on a photograph of her mother, a Buddhist and fourth-generation rancher, amid a tangle of trees. "This is where I was conceived," she says, "in her forest." In a family of ranchers, Hearst describes herself as the odd one out. As a child, she loved to draw. Once, after watching the transformation scene in Disney's Cinderella, she took a pair of scissors to her grandmother's silk dress. While attending the British schools, a high school in Montevideo, Hearst won a scholarship to spend a year in Australia, which kicked off a decade of travel. She returned home to study communications at the Universidad Orte Uruguay, left again to model in Paris and Milan, and joined the neighborhood playhouse Acting Conservancy in Manhattan. Acting didn't stick, but New York did. In 2003, following a stint as a sales director in a showroom, Hearst launched a Brooklyn-based contemporary line called Candela. In Spanish, the word means cheeky. In physics, it's a measure of luminous intensity, with two partners and an investment of $700 each. The brand's earliest offering was a T-shirt printed with a silk-screened image of a winged woman on horseback. The photograph of Hearst's mother that inspired it is still propped in her office. A decade later, the brand was profitable, and Hearst was a member of the Council of Fashion Designers of America. That year, she married Austin, a grandson of publishing scion William Randolph Hearst, whom she met at a party in Buenos Aires in 2004. "Initially, I didn't like him," Hearst once told Vogue, "but he became one of Candela's early investors, and now she describes him as one of my muses. He's one of these people that sees 10 years ahead of the game," she says. "He has this kind of vision." The pair founded Hearst eponymous brand in 2015 and now split their time between their West Village townhouse, marble, leather, and inherited bibelot from Hearst Castle, and a place outside Garrison, New York, in the Hudson Valley, reclaimed wood, Nakashima chairs. They have a 7-year-old son, plus Hearst's 14-year-old twin daughters from her previous marriage and Austin's 2 children from his. The Gabriella Hearst debut collection, which Barney's stocked right next to Chloe, featured a calf-length leather skirt, a sheer navy dress with immaculate knife pleats and delicate V-neck sweaters. In 2017, after Donald Trump took office, Hearst designed a merino wool sweater with a graphic of a stylized ram's head that could also be read as ovaries and a uterus. She sold each of the 100 pieces for $699, $500 of which went to Planned Parenthood. When the Supreme Court handed down the Dobbs decision last year, she reissued the sweater under the same terms. A trip with the humanitarian aid organization's Save the Children to Turkana, Kenya later that year prompted her laser focus on sustainability. The country was in the middle of a drought that has only intensified, she says. And she met mothers who had to make the hard choice of what child to save, to take to a clinic where they have to walk for kilometers. There is no water. All the livestock is dead. Developing nations, she says, are paying the price for how we live in the developed world. Some say that there's no such thing as ethical consumption under capitalism. Hearst is a pragmatist. I'm a luxury designer, she says. A luxury designer means that you need to know where everything comes from and how everything is made, from soup to nuts. In 2019, she's widely credited with the fashion industry's first carbon-neutral runway show, working with the production company Bureau Betac to assess and reduce the show's carbon footprint, and then with the climate consultancy EcoAct to provide a carbon offset by donating to the Hifadi Livelihoods Project, which provides efficient cook stoves to communities in Kenya's Embu and Tharaka Nithi counties. When I ask Hearst, who spends significant time on airplanes between New York, Paris, and Uruguay, and also on inspiration-gathering trips with her team, including for the Fusion Collection, whether all that jet fuel causes her grief, she tells me that she has moved up from offsetting and now works with Climate Works to sequester her carbon load. All of these endeavors cost money, but what's the real cost, Hearst asks. We're pushing forward this bill that no one's paying. Somebody has to say we are responsible. We have to find a way because of our children, the next generation. The world is theirs. It's not ours anymore. And if you don't take the role of our guardianship seriously, meaning at all cost, she trails off. For all her engagement with hard science, Hearst identifies as a spiritual person. Her family didn't want to baptize her, but I ask to be baptized. I believe in Jesus in the way I believe in Buddha, in the way I believe in all deities. I think spirituality is part of the human condition, she says. I know a lot of things exist that I don't see. It's possible Hearst's role at Chloe, a label launched in Paris in 1952 by Gabriel Arian, a Jewish communist sympathizer who hired Karl Lagerfeld to succeed her, was a self-fulfilling prophecy. Hearst's first luxury purchase, she says, was a Chloe Edith bag. Later, she had a dream that she was helming the brand. In 2020, she submitted a 92-page brief on her proposed direction for the brand. The main driver, she says, besides my love for Chloe, was to see if the 7 years that we have had at Gabriella Hearst as research and development on environmental practices could be upscaled to a brand that was 70 years old. And how fast can that deployment be? Faster than expected, it turned out. Last fall, under the direction of Hearst and CEO Riccardo Bellini, Chloe became the first luxury fashion house B Corp, a designation given to corporations that meet criteria pertaining to transparency and high standards of social and environmental performance. Chloe currently scores an 85.2. 80 is the bar for certification, and the median score for typical businesses is 50.9. Next photos. Chloe models wear looks inspired by the colors and silhouettes of fashion laboratories. The brand's lower-impact Nama sneaker comprises 40% of its weight from recycled materials. October 2021 was precisely when Fusion seized Hearst, as she read an article in the Financial Times on its feasibility, once a far distant hope that in recent years has begun to seem tantalizingly close. "And then I started to research," she says. She read about the most expansive nuclear fusion project on Earth, a 35-nation and thus far nearly three-decades-long collaboration called the International Thermonuclear Experimental Reactor, or ITER, Latin for the Way, which is under construction some 650 kilometers south of Paris in Saint-Paul-l'Hurance. Upon completion, it will be the world's largest tokamak. The project began with a handshake between Mikhail Gorbachev and Ronald Reagan and will, per its mission statement, prove the feasibility of fusion as a large-scale and carbon-free source of energy. She learned about the private companies throughout the world on their own races toward fusion. She became so entrenched that on occasion, when speaking about the star builders, she refers to them as we. She's got great neuroplasticity, says ITER communications director Laban Koblenz of Hearst. "I would swear that in 7 years of bringing every kind of visitor here, technically smart people, people with engineering degrees, senators and parliamentarians, and even heads of state, I would say when Gabby showed up on the 10th of May, she was the most well-educated layperson on fusion science I had ever seen." Hearst visited Commonwealth Fusion Systems, a private Massachusetts-based company founded in collaboration with MIT that aims to produce net energy plasma by 2025, and Washington-based Helion, which has a target for commercial systems on the grid by the end of this decade. For most of its history, in discussions of fusion building, people often use the analogy of building a cathedral, says Alex Creeley, the CFS plasma physicist who weighed in on the creation of Chloe's tokamak-esque runway. "Building a cathedral took 100 years. You might never achieve it in your lifetime, but you're contributing to something grand." For those working in the field today, that's no longer the case. While the boom in fusion will feel sudden to some, just days before the Chloe show in the fall, the Department of Energy announced a $50 million earmark to be dispersed among for-profit fusion companies teaming up with universities and national labs. It's the result of decades of research and innovation. "I like taking the pandemic case as a comparison," says Hearst. "We had a vaccine within a year, when people were predicting 4 years, and billions of dollars went into this vaccine because the alternative 4 years of lockdown on the economy would have not been acceptable. We are in the case here that I would argue is worse." "The more I talk to people," Hearst says, "the more I realized there's a communication bridge. People just don't know about this." Per Koblenz, Gabby has a unique sense of how the artistic temperament and the scientific temperament can help to advance each other's narratives. Hearst is executing her climate narrative over 4 collections. For fall 2022, she focused on the concept of rewilding, and with input from the British conservationist Isabella Tree, filled her runway with a physical manifestation of her anxiety reduction list: recycled cashmere sweaters and painted leather bags, a waste product of the meat industry, she says, that portrayed images of disaster on one side, a scorched mountain landscape, melting icebergs, and success on the other, a field of poppies, below a green peak, a pair of polar bears. "All humans, we're all connected. All species, we're all connected. We all live in this environment. The idea of a division is a false concept," Hearst says. Next, her primarily monochromatic resort collection served as the introductory course in her stealth mission to deliver fusion literacy to the masses. Laser-cut star motifs, spangled black leather jackets, embroidery anglaise frocks, and spring-summer, bursting with color and symbolism, as her masterclass. "What I can do is to use whatever platform I have to communicate about this energy. The final chapter in Hurst's ongoing creative endeavor, she tells me, is really understanding our brain. How do we make better informed decisions? We need to change a bit of our consciousness in order to evolve, because there's something about our programming that's just not working right now. I understand that I can close my eyes and go to watch Netflix and drink a matcha latte, but that is a sort of apathy, Hurst says. If you are not in a position of survival, you need to help others, and you need to be of service. With her vast network of resources, I chose to have a family, and my husband, I chose to have these two jobs. I had a very dangerous pregnancy with my daughters. My son was 7 rounds of IVF. She delivers this in the same neutral, propulsive tone she employed when describing how she persuaded a 70-year-old Parisian fashion house to translate a theoretical scientific endeavor into a tangible collection of luxury women's wear. Everything I've done in my life that is worth it, it has taken a lot of work. Thank you. At lavish gatherings from Monaco to the Middle East, Anthony Ratosa built a lucrative business convening the titans who control the family offices of the uber-wealthy. But the self-styled Knight of the Realm and purported Nobel Prize nominee turned out to be a Wall Street washout, a deadbeat dad, and a dangerous con man. The Knight's Tale by Adam Sierowski, with the illustrations by Mark Smith. Opening illustration shows a mixed group of internationals at an outdoor party. It was a warm June evening in Monaco. Outside, yachts were plying the Azure Sea. Inside, flashbulbs were popping. Anthony Ratosa was in his element. Charming and cherubic, Ratosa was glad-handing in front of a step-and-repeat backdrop at the Fairmont Monte Carlo. His permatan, sun-kissed hair, and tailored suit suggested a man of refined wealth and taste. An outsider might easily have mistaken the scene for a movie premiere in nearby Cannes, but that would have undersold the pomp and pomposity of the moment. Sir Anthony, as he likes to be called, was holding court, welcoming guests to his 19th Ratosa Family Office Investment Summit, a confab of royals, sheikhs, and ultra-high-net-worth individuals that he bills as the most highly acclaimed gathering of global wealth of all time. By his count, people representing over $4.5 trillion in investor wealth have shown up at his conferences in Dubai, Miami, Monaco, and Riyadh, events where startups and entrepreneurs come to pitch the rich, and have walked away, in Ratosa's estimate, with more than $2.8 billion in new funding. The gathering this past summer was held under the high patronage of His Serene Highness Prince Albert II of Monaco. Though the prince was not on hand, his endorsement loomed large. His name topped the invitations. His foundation's logo was splashed across a banner along the red carpet. Ratosa's regal affiliations, however, extend beyond this microstate on the Côte d'Azur. Members of some of the most powerful families in the Gulf, Al Khalifa, Bahrain, Al Maktoum, UAE, Al Nahyan, UAE, Al Saud, Saudi Arabia, and Al Thani, Qatar, have had their names and pictures emblazoned on promotional materials for Ratosa's soirees. Other dynasties have graced the publicity announcements. Von Bismarck, Bonaparte, Kennedy, Rockefeller, along with people purportedly affiliated with such heavyweight brands as Amazon, Audible, Facebook, Meta, and Rothschild & Company. One of the Monaco Affair's platinum sponsors was the crypto newcomer Unicoin, represented on the agenda by Rosie Rios, 43rd U.S. Treasurer, and Joe Biden's choice to lead America's 250th Anniversary Commission, who had given a keynote at the previous Ratosa meeting in Riyadh. In short, Sir Anthony's summits are so chock-a-block with luminaries that many associated with the event may have failed to ask one fundamental question. Who the hell is Anthony Ratosa? After a year-long investigation, including interviews with sources from a dozen countries, Vanity Fair uncovered the truth. It turns out he is a Wall Street washout, a world-class con man, and an inveterate fabulist with a bogus CV and persona. A 53-year-old Australian who fancifully purports to be an heir to a 600-year-old European olive oil fortune. What's more, he entices people to attend his summits under often dubious pretenses, not infrequently requesting a cut of the action from presenters. And finally, the self-proclaimed maestro of family wealth is actually a thrice-married deadbeat dad who has been repeatedly jailed in Europe and is wanted in the U.S. after threatening to harm his own wife and family. A man about whom Lieutenant Greg Sancho of the Pelham Manor, New York Police Department told Vanity Fair We have an active warrant for Anthony Ritosa's arrest for criminal contempt in the first degree. That's a felony. I had heard complaints about Ritosa's summits from a circle of entrepreneurs who felt hoodwinked. So to get a better handle on the guy, I first stopped in London in June to attend the Family Office Forum, held a week before Sir Anthony's. Put on by Prestel and Partner, it is one of the best-regarded gatherings of its kind and took place at the posh Corinthia Hotel, a stone's throw from 10 Downing Street. In the often alien patois of finance, family offices are easy to understand. They are privately held companies the super-rich use to manage their fortunes. Genuine family offices, in the eyes of finance professionals, are those with at least $100 million in investable assets. Such entities, often overseen by professionals working with a cadre of relatives, tend to have fewer institutional controls and a high risk tolerance, allowing them to funnel a portion of their wealth into ventures with less predictable returns. As a result, family offices can be prime targets for financial predators. The London conference, organized by Tobias Prestel, a German entrepreneur, and the banking veteran Katja Mülheim, was attended by an array of industrialists, aristocrats, ultra-high net worth individuals, and family offices from around the world. Prestel sat down with me and took me back to 2014. At that year's event, held in Zurich, Ritosa sent a representative. What played in Anthony's favor, when we looked to see if he qualified as a family office, said Prestel, was that there was almost no negative information about him online. Around that time, in bios submitted to similar conferences in Miami, Ritosa presented himself as having an MBA with distinction in finance from Harvard University. His personal narrative would later appear on his website, on LinkedIn, and in publications targeting the mega-rich. He boasted of a distinguished Wall Street career and more than 30 years of international financial markets and investment experience. Ritosa also claimed to be an heir to an olive oil fortune dating back to the 15th century. The story is colorful. The gnarled roots of the Ritosa olive groves have persevered through war and natural disaster, and under the rule of warrior princes, wealthy merchant kings, and modern despots. The company's fields, he noted, have long been in Istria, a peninsula that was once part of Italy but now largely straddles Croatia and Slovenia. He talked about his olive oil fortune all the time, explained Jason Kavanaugh, an Australian who runs his own Monaco-based family office. He presents very well. I ran across Anthony at conferences in Monaco, London, and Geneva around 2014 to 2015. He introduced himself as a fellow Australian running a family office, looking to get involved in the family office community. He absolutely was not a sir then. Matthias Knob was strolling the beach in Miami in early 2016 when he ran into his old acquaintance, Anthony Ritosa. He had not seen him in years. Cerebral and solemn, Knob runs the alternative investment media firm Opalesque and serves as a senior advisor to Castle Hall, an international due diligence company. We chatted, Knob recalled, over tea at a mosaiced garden in London's Westminster, and he said he's been doing stuff with his family office, which was weird because he was a typical salesman, selling structured notes to hedge funds. When I knew him, I didn't think of Anthony as a high net worth individual. At first, Ritosa attended family office focused conferences, but in 2016, he co-hosted his own, a joint venture between a Kuwaiti conglomerate and his newly minted Ritosa family office, representing his family business dating back 600 years to the Venetian Empire. Together, they put on two summits in Dubai. But according to Knob, who helped advertise the latter, Ritosa was eager to go solo. Anthony rang me in March 2017 and said he wanted to do a family office conference in Monaco in June, recalled Kavanaugh. I thought he meant 2018, but he wanted it 3 months later. I told him it couldn't be done. But Anthony went ahead and put my name on the program as chairman of the conference. Kavanaugh, peeved but not dissuaded, was sufficiently well-placed in Monaco to attract the principality's high and mighty. Even though I never agreed to it, it was too late to pull out, or I would have looked like a clown. Knob moderated panels, and Opalesque served as a media partner, helping telegraph the event's importance to the financial world. That first summit in Monaco was very low profile, Giuseppe Ambrosio remembered, as we had coffee at the Hotel Hermitage Monte Carlo, an architectural gem with a glass cupola designed by Gustave Eiffel. Back then, Ambrosio was an audit partner for Deloitte and president of the Monaco Single and Multifamily Office International Association. As his relationship with Ritosa blossomed, he began opening some very important doors. I vouched for him with the prince and the palace, Ambrosio said regretfully, and in 2018, following the usual vetting, Ambrosio recalled, Ritosa's patronage request was granted. Yet, as Ritosa's ambitions and audacity grew, his conference changed their tenor, and his origin story, as revealed here for the first time, began to disintegrate. Sir Anthony's only U.S. summit took place in Miami in late 2017 at the St. Regis Bal Harbour Resort. It was a two-day thing, said Kavanaugh, who chaired the affair. Some good families, some good topics, but a little crypto started creeping in. Knob was there as well and recalled, initially these conferences were really sweet. Planning, however, was hampered when Ritosa went off the grid 2 months before the kickoff, a time when Knob was scheduled to visit him in Slovenia, where Ritosa sometimes stays when he is not at his penthouse in Dubai's luxurious Bulgari residences. As the trip grew near, Knob recounted, the Australian was simply unreachable. This was actually the first red flag. Upon re-emerging, Ritosa explained his absence via WhatsApp. I just got back from Sydney this evening. It's been a rough 2 weeks with my mum. She had a stroke and is now stable, thankfully. I'm back and can now focus 100% on Miami. The summit proceeded. But by the following March, at the next conclave in Dubai, the atmosphere had changed. It was nothing like what Ritosa was advertising, Knob maintained. It became a massive circus with lots of sellers hawking offerings and crypto. It became a huge machine for Ritosa. Knob had seen enough. In June, he announced that he and Kavanaugh were terminating their relationship with Ritosa summits, citing differences over the direction of these conferences and other reasons. Kavanaugh also pulled out of the fast-approaching 2018 gathering in Monaco, which he says he was slated to chair, prompting a key Monaco minister to bail. The 1-2 punch riled Ritosa, who pleaded with his fellow Aussie over WhatsApp, "Can you please stop arranging for other people to resign? That's not appropriate, mate." Meanwhile, Ritosa's Slovenian lawyer sent a letter to Knob, ordering him to remove his post and threatening litigation. Knob did not budge. Ritosa backed off. Still, the summit, with Prince Albert as patron, went on anyway. "Little by little, I learned," Ambrosio confided. "The biggest mistake I made was to take him to the palace and help him get the patronage so that the conference looks like it's blessed by Prince Albert." Ambrosio, like Kavanaugh, Knob, and others, asserted he has cut all ties with Ritosa. "Then, when he started calling himself Sir, I couldn't stand it." Indeed, Ritosa's image and his enterprise were about to get even stranger. It was at the 2019 Monaco summit that Ritosa received his own lofty title when the Knights Society of Elvinia inducted him into their ranks, thereby catapulting a man born Anthony Ronnie Ritosa to Sir Anthony. The new knight would later receive the Grand Cross from the Royal Order of Banu Asaf. Behind these accolades stood two enigmatic men, both of whom have served as key figures in Ritosa's orbit. The first was His Excellency Professor Sir Manuel Freire Garibal y Núñez, who describes himself as a Spanish lawyer, diplomat, and journalist, and founder and chairman of Al Khalifa Business School, AKBS. Though grammar and spelling are not his strong suits, the young Spaniard, in his online profile, claims to hold an MBA and to have completed more than 300 courses and specializations in different areas from Ivy League and elite business schools. He states that he has served as a contributor of higher education to UC Berkeley, USC, and Yale, and as a professor, collaborator, and advisor to many universities across the globe, including the Harvard Medical School, all at age 27. But there's more. Freire Garibal says he founded the Knight Society of Elvina in 2016 as a hobby and now serves as its Grand Chancellor. Over the years, he purports to have racked up high civil honors from the states of Arkansas and Kentucky and the local governments of Machu Picchu, Medley, and North Miami Beach. What's more, Sir Manuel's website, a must-read, notes that the Russian Federation presented him with the Grand Cross of Ruby Arslanga, an honor, he claims, that has previously gone to Cuba's Fidel Castro, as well as second- and third-class personalities of art and culture, such as Alec Baldwin. And here, his first name is misspelled. Also central to Sir Anthony's Knight's tale is His Highness Mahmoud Salah al-Din Asaf, a hereditary royal prince of the 7th century Asaf dynasty of the Mamluk Sultanate of the Persian Kesterwan of Mount Lebanon. Judging from the glamour shot that accompanies his online resumes, the man is a passionate falconer. At 36, he claims to have received some extraordinary honors, including the Presidential Lifetime Achievement Award and the highest title of honor bestowed by the governor of Kentucky. Still, these seem like small ball compared with what he cites as his 2015 appointment as ambassador at large of the UN-registered Brotherhood of Dragons. More on His Excellency and His Highness shortly. Neither would talk for this story. Moreover, Ritosa, after replying to an initial email, did not respond to numerous requests to participate, nor did he agree to answer questions submitted by Vanity Fair. Ritosa's 13th summit was in full swing at Dubai's Waldorf Astoria Palm Jumeirah on December 8, 2020, when 3,500 miles away in Germany, Matthias Knob received an unexpected message. It included a link to a website called fakefamilyoffice.com that began, "I need to warn you about a nefarious operator, Anthony Ritosa, who is a pretender in the world of family offices and should not be trusted with your time and essentially your money." What followed was a takedown that questioned and mocked Sir Anthony's title, educational credentials, career milestones, and claims about an olive oil fortune and a family office. Denny Charid, a one-time financial journalist who now runs his own private wealth meetings, also passed info from the link around. Word filtered back to Ritosa, and Charid, like Knob, soon received a cease and desist letter from Ritosa's Slovenian attorney. Charid was amused by the suggestion that he had defamed Ritosa merely by sharing the contents of a public domain URL. "This is so ridiculous, I will not even bring it to my lawyer's attention," he wrote back, adding, "I believe most of the website's claims." In time, Ritosa's lawyers would send a similarly toothless warning to Graham David Bell, a Dubai-based corporate finance advisor whose clients include some very real and very wealthy sheikhs. As a Brit and the son of a man knighted by Queen Elizabeth II for his service in World War II, Bell took special umbrage with Ritosa's regal shtick. Upon receiving an unsolicited invitation from Sir Anthony to come as a VIP guest to his 18th conference in Riyadh, to be held under the high patronage of His Royal Highness Prince Abdullah bin Musad bin Abdulaziz Al Saud, Bell balked. He doubted the royal stamp of approval and reached out to the supposed patron's close associates, only to be told, he said, that the prince had neither agreed to be a sponsor nor allowed his name and likeness to be used. The prince's representatives declined to comment. At that point, Bell advised several Saudis not to attend. Ritosa caught wind, and to hear Bell tell it went full aggro, issuing cease and desist orders through council, along with heavy-handed warnings that the Brit could be imprisoned and forced to pay millions under the UAE's defamation laws. "We told them, 'Sue me, I dare you,'" Bell explained. "Silence ever since. That's what Ritosa does. Threats, bluster, and then beating a sheepish retreat." I spoke with some 20 past attendees of summits in Dubai, Miami, Monaco, and Riyadh, many of whom shared stories of how they or their colleagues were persuaded to attend and pay significant fees based on Ritosa's pledge to offer access to a raft of high net worth investors. Instead, what they tended to find was a smattering of people with money, but little evident interest in deploying it, and a contingent of conference regulars, some of whom came to resemble role players, listening to pitches from hopeful entrepreneurs, but not coughing up the capital Ritosa claims is there for the taking. In the opinion of these conference goers, it is a far cry from what Sir Anthony aggressively promises, that those seeking investment can expect to find many deeply pocketed people ready, willing, and able to write a check. An American participant broke it down this way. For a basic pass, it's around $5,000. If you want meetings, it's a minimum of $18,000. I paid that twice, and they put me in front of bullshit people who didn't have money. Said a European businessman who shelled out a pretty penny, "There's nothing wrong with charging $200,000 if you're delivering, but we were sitting inside a summit with hardly anybody with money, only people looking for money." "It's souk behavior," said Dana Al-Salem, who has been a panelist and moderator at several summits. She has founded tech, media, and entertainment companies and runs in important social circles in Dubai. "If the prices weren't so unreasonable and conference organizers weren't taking a cut, then it's a networking event," she said. "I speak at a lot of conferences. Never once have I heard of a host saying, 'Any money you make from an investor you meet, you need to give me a cut.'" Some, like Asalem, were willing to speak on the record. Others were embarrassed that as fiduciaries they had paid 5 to 6 figures and in return received the Potemkin Village version of the festivities that appear in slick videos posted on the Ritosa family office website. Still, there are others, like Carrie Adler, who remain bullish about the gatherings. "I've met so many quality people from so many walks of life," he explained. "It's almost like it's become a family, a get-together for people where they talk about what they're investing in." Adler is the Canadian CEO of a solar energy concern, SkyPower Global, who has spoken at 9 symposia. "There's a lot of potential investors there. Now, are they writing checks? I honestly don't know. No one's opened a checkbook and given me a check. I'm not personally aware of any groups that raise large amounts of capital at these events." Next illustration, the great pretender, Anthony Ritosa, host of wealth summits in Dubai, Miami, Monaco, and Riyadh, has been repeatedly arrested by European authorities. The more I probed, the more apparent it became. Anthony Ronnie Ritosa's shiny story is not only a fable, but a very dark one. And as I got to know some of his old friends, others with close knowledge of the Ritosa family, and a whistleblower who came out of the woodwork, I discovered that Ritosa's slippery demise and reincarnation really began 10 years ago as his personal and professional lives started to spiral and he began to reinvent himself in an effort to erase his past. First, some background. Ritosa was born in Sydney in 1969 to working-class parents. The family would occasionally visit the Istrian Peninsula in present-day Croatia, where the Ritosas had Italian roots. After attending a Tony private school in Sydney, the Scots College, he graduated from the University of Newcastle, a fact he has edited out of his narrative. There are other discrepancies as well. We don't have any record of this person as an MBA graduate, a senior official at Harvard Business School insisted after I inquired about Ritosa's claim to have an MBA with distinction in finance from Harvard University. The source continued, he did complete an HBS online course in negotiation mastery, but that certainly is not an MBA, and we only offer a general management MBA. We don't have specialized ones like in finance. Finally, I would be remiss not to add what Harvard Medical School said when asked about Sir Manuel's contention that he has been a professor, collaborator, and/or advisor there. We are unable to find any records of this individual being or having ever been on our faculty, working as a researcher, instructor, or a student at HMS. Resume padding is the least of it. There is no olive oil fortune, or as one former Ritosa associate put it, maybe there were olives in his family's garden. Another close colleague explained he wants to be seen to have that profile of a high net worth family office chairman. I have not seen proof that qualifies him as being a family office. Sources close to the Ritosa family are withering about the man and the myth. Anthony's the kind of guy that always takes a shortcut, said one. If there's a convenient shortcut, which may or may not be legitimate or ethical or the right thing to do, but it's a shortcut, he will take it. Another commented, he is a highly intelligent and manipulative man with great persuasive powers and the ability to gain confidence, a classic trait all con men have. In the September 15, 2002 New York Times announcement of Ritosa's first marriage to the former Jocelyn Ring, there is no mention of olive oil, a family office, or a fortune. Instead, Ritosa, then 33, was described as a broker at Morgan Stanley in New York who develops trading strategies for hedge funds and whose father had retired as a residential property developer in Sydney. As for Ritosa's studies, the Times noted that he graduated from the University of Newcastle in Australia and received an MBA from the University of Technology in Sydney. The origins of Ritosa olive oil are far more recent and pedestrian. The firm was registered in New York in 2010, with Ritosa's second wife, Sandra, listed as a co-founder. Trying to find the company or buy its products online, however, is a maddening and ultimately futile exercise. Search results redirect to the Ritosa family office or to websites touting tasting competitions the company has supposedly won, but which all end up at the same phone number. The shell game, I learned, is all about putting on airs for a man who most certainly is not an heir. And as for the oil itself, on February 9, 2013, Croatian police arrested a 44-year-old Australian for allegedly stealing 24 bottles of olive oil from a warehouse in the town of Poreč. Coverage in local papers at the time did not name the suspect, but Darko Kadum did. It was Anthony Ritosa, the former director of MIH, the enterprise that controlled the warehouse, told me when I visited him and his wife Luana at their village in the hills above Poreč. At the mention of Sir Anthony's six-century-old fortune, the couple laughed. There may be a few olive trees in front of his family home, Kadum posited, but the olive oil is not produced from those olives. A close family source concurred, there is no 600-year-old family fortune. There are no ties to the Venetian Empire. As it turns out, Ritosa, according to the Kadums, had a deal to import MIH's olive oil to the U.S. with Ritosa's own label affixed to the kegs, not an uncommon practice. When we met, he was a very sweet-talking man, and I'm sure many people would wish to have him as a friend, Kadum explained. We had an intense friendship. Darko visited Ritosa in New York, and along with Luana, got to know Sir Anthony's family when they came to Istria. But, he said, over time, Anthony changed who he was. By 2012, by Kadum's accounting, Ritosa had accrued $40,000 in unpaid invoices, and MIH stopped the shipments. His friend's increasingly bizarre actions, including the caper at the warehouse, were the final straw, Kadum recalled. The police actually caught him somewhere in the city. They took the oil and brought it back to us, and that was it. Thus, the man whose family office narrative is literally rooted in the roots of Istrian olive trees appears to have been more of an olive oil robber than robber baron. It all traces back to the summer of 2012. Ritosa was on holiday in Istria with Sandra and their two young daughters. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico, interval selection by Mark Hoffman.